We want to ask our first speaker for today, Karen Parker, to start the session, which is on international law.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here. I found out about DU weaponry in 1996 and immediately began to condemn it at the United Nations Human Rights Forums. I was convinced that such weaponry could not be used without violating humanitarian or armed conflict law, and accordingly was already banned by operation of existing law. As a consequence of their use would necessarily constitute grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions and other violations of humanitarian law. The fact that the United Nations took up this issue as soon as I brought it up supports my opinion. The presentations at the 1996 session of the United Nations Commission on Human Rights and at the subcommission, which is now renamed the Subcommission on Promotion and Protection of Human Rights, focused on the use of DU weaponry in the Gulf, in the first Gulf War, for obvious reasons of time. The members were highly shocked and moved by the presentation of DU weaponry, many of them only finding out about DU for the first time. The member of the subcommission at that time who introduced the resolution was Claire Pally from the United Kingdom, who was subsequently off the subcommission, and another person from the UK has supported her. The subcommission in 1996 found the use of DU weapons incompatible with existing armed conflict and human rights law. What that means is it's illegal. What the subcommission also did was ask the United Nations Secretary General through the Secretariat to look into the issue, seek information, advice, and guidance, and report back to the subcommission at its 1997 session. I wrote a memorandum on the law of armed the law of weapons to submit to the Secretary General, which I did, and he took about 8 of my best pages and most of my good citations and put it in his report. His report also contains a number of other statements and submissions by governments, non-governmental organizations, and specialized agencies of the United Nations. As a result of that, the United Nations subcommission again condemned depleted uranium, calling it incompatible with existing norms, and asked one of its members to prepare a paper. That member from Colombia never returned to the subcommission and therefore never submitted a paper. We consider that she was probably heavily pressured and lobbied by the United States to not return to the subcommission. And when her term was up, she was not proposed by her government, so therefore she was not reelected. Meanwhile, we already had 2 resolutions condemning depleted uranium, and we had a report of the Secretary General containing a lot of the comments and commentary about the illegality of depleted uranium. So for the next couple of years, we kept up the pressure by making presentations, making our oral and written statements, showing films, spreading the word among UN members. Then the Balkan situation unraveled, and there was renewed interest in depleted uranium, not only because of concerns raised by the government of Iraq, but now the then government of the former Yugoslavia became very active in our anti-DU campaigning at the United Nations. Then in 2001, a Justice CQN from Mauritius was approached by the members of the subcommission if he would be interested in taking on the paper that was assigned to the woman from Colombia and that she never prepared. And he said he would, and a resolution was tabled to that effect. I don't want to go through all of the mechanics of it, but you should know that the member from the UK, the new member from the UK, immediately tried to block this. tried to get DU removed from the resolution so that Justice CQN would deal with some of the other weapons, such as cluster bombs and landmines and atomic and that kind of thing, while the member from the UK would deal with DU. This was, of course, not accepted. The members of the subcommittee rejected, and I'm sure that they felt that what she would do would be not exactly unbiased, and would, in fact, probably try to challenge the subcommittee's own resolution, finding depleted uranium weapons illegal. When Justice CQN submitted his first report, which was submitted in 2002, as could be expected, the member from the UK strongly argued against it. However, most of the other members argued in favor of it, liked it very, very much indeed. In fact, did something rather unprecedented, and for this I have to back off a little. When Justice CQN was given the assignment to do the paper, at the next session of the Commission on Human Rights, the United States and the UK carried out a campaign against him. He was up for re-election, and he was not re-elected. The US and UK thought that since he was no longer a member of the subcommission, that he wouldn't submit the report. It was a way of stopping the report. However, he submitted the report anyway, and the US and UK were very, very angry. In spite of their obvious anger at the subcommission session, the members of the subcommission, as I said, did something quite extraordinary. They asked Justice CQN to submit a follow-up paper, knowing that he was no longer a member of the subcommission, but at that time they did have authority to continue work with a non-member if they chose. They had only done it once before. So they asked Justice CQN to prepare a second paper. When the Commission on Human Rights met in the year 2003, this year, what the Commission on Human Rights did was pass a resolution taking away from the subcommission the right to appoint someone to do any work that was no longer a member of the subcommission. Obviously, this was a targeted resolution, targeted right at Justice CQN. And they expected that because of that, he would not submit the follow-up paper. However, he did submit the follow-up paper. The US and the UK were very angry at that. It was very obvious from the statements of the member of the subcommission from the UK that what she was desperately trying to do yet again was take over the paper, and what she would do would be simply to rewrite it the following year. The subcommission rejected that completely and allowed the two reports of Justice CQN to speak for themselves. The subcommission made the decision that they had condemned depleted uranium and these other weapons. They had asked the Secretary General to do a report, which he did. They had listened to years of testimony. They asked a member to do a study, a paper, which he did, and a follow-up paper. And the subcommission said, you know, we have nothing else to say. DU weapons are illegal. We've written about it. We've shown it. We've demonstrated. We've did a legal analysis. The book is closed. Not in sense that they would, it was closed as far as direct action by the subcommission. So it went as far as the subcommission can go. These documents are official UN documents. They're out there circulating, and countries are on notice. It's important to know why depleted uranium is illegal, because there is no treaty condemning depleted uranium. So when there's no treaty, you have to now analyze the weapon in light of existing norms, which is what the subcommission process was all about. And it's also about what the International Court of Justice said in its 1996 opinion has to be done when there's no actual treaty. You use the whole area of customary international law. So looking at all of customary international law binding on all countries in the world, why is depleted uranium weaponry illegal? Well, first of all, let's set out the test for weapons. This test derives from, as I said, all of customary international law relating to armed conflict. Armed conflict law covers how wars are fought, meaning military operations. Humanitarian law governs what weapons are used in war and what military tactics are used with those weapons in war. And of course, humanitarian law has a whole body of law which protects victims of armed conflict. Looking at all three branches of humanitarian law, there are four rules. I say four rules. Mr. CQN says five, but you'll see why I use my own formula in a minute. There are four rules derived from all of customary humanitarian law. One, when the war is fought, it can only be fought where the war is fought, against legal military targets. I know it sounds a little silly to say the war can only be fought where the war is fought and against legal military targets, but you can't have a war between country A and country B and attack country C and not have legal liability. And you can't target civilian or non-legal military targets. This is called the territory test. You can only have a war in the legal field of battle. Secondly, once again, it's going to sound a little simplistic. When the war is over, the war is over. When the war is all over, that means the instrumentalities, the material, the armaments of war must cease, or you're still in a state of war. Quite obvious. This is called the time test. The war lasts as long as the war lasts. The third rule about weapons, applying that rule to weapons, obviously, is weapons have to stop when the war is over. The third rule about weapons is that weapons may not be unduly inhumane. This is called the humanity test. Actually, this is one of the very earliest rules in customary humanitarian law and became part of the two Hague Conventions, one in 1899 and one in 1907. These conventions use the terms weapons are banned if they cause unnecessary suffering and superfluous injury. Superfluous injury is a concept that in part arises from the principle of necessity. Let me explain. This is a little dense, but give me a minute. Superfluous injury means injuries that don't help your war effort. In other words, you injured someone and it didn't help. In this concept, think in terms of a weapon, for instance, that you're in the middle of a battle and you're using a weapon that has a certain effect in that battle, but then also has an effect 10 years later over here. Was it necessary to affect a person 10 years after the war is over in order to achieve the purposes of the war, which is the surrender of the enemy? Weapons may not be unduly inhumane. Four, weapons may not have a negative effect on the environment, an undue negative effect on the environment. This actually is the newest provision in humanitarian law. It is first in some of the papers evolving in customary law that resulted in it being included in the protocols additional to the Geneva Conventions in 1977. And of course, we owe the inclusion of this concept in the customary rules to the environment movement. It's obvious from what you've heard in this conference and anything you read about DU that DU weaponry fails these tests. There is absolutely no way that you can have those particles stay right there only on that legal military target, the tank. Now, I'm not talking about when you miss the tank and hit a schoolyard. That's illegal for two reasons if you've used DU weaponry. First of all, it's an illegal target, and second of all, it has an inhumane effect. But in the concept of territory, you can't keep DU in a legal field of battle. You can't even keep it in the same countries that are at war. So, it's traveling. Second of all, time. How can DU weapons possibly meet the time test? Now, I have never heard a scientist tell me how to turn DU off when the war is over. You know, stop. No more emissions. Stop. Time's up. We're in peace now. Call in the weapons. Now, you can take a landmine off a field of battle at the end of a war. You cannot take DU off the field of battle at the end of the war. Let's talk about inhumane weaponry. I know you've seen the pictures, you've heard the doctors, you've heard the scientists. Tell me how possibly, any military advantage could be obtained from causing a next generation of deformed babies. Tell me how you can possibly justify a weapon that doesn't kill the person on the battlefield who might be a legal military target but kills him 5 years later with cancer. An element, once again, in this inhumaneness is linked to efficacy in battle. In war, you're allowed to kill the enemy soldiers only in proportion to what is needed for you to achieve your military goal. When the vast majority of what DU does as far as killing soldiers is killing them when there's no longer a war or killing their children, in spite of the fact it's a great anti-tank weapon, you can't justify it militarily. When you're judging a weapon for the principle of necessity, you can't just look at one thing it does. You have to look at everything it does. So you have to balance its anti-tank capacity against what it does in future generations, or when the war is over, or in fact, how it kills. And obviously, DU weapons violate the principles relating to protection of the environment. How can you possibly say that a DU-riddled battlefield isn't an environmental problem? 2 minutes? Okay. I'm assuming that you can understand that having children born after the war with deformities has at least a hint that possibly DU weaponry violates principles prohibiting genocide. Let's look at how bad is DU weaponry. Well, I'm not a scientist. You hear a range of how bad it is, but I can guarantee you that the subcommission would have found DU weaponry illegal even if it only did one-tenth of what people here have presented if it does. As a matter of fact, they might have found it incompatible with existing norms if there was a chance it might be one-tenth as bad as you've heard today. We'll never actually map out all the reasons why DU is bad. But the fact that we don't know down to hook, line, and sinker everything about the effect of DU does not mean that it's therefore illegal until we find out all the science. We know enough. It's bad enough. There's also controversies about whether DU weaponry is conventional or nuclear. I don't know, personally. I'm not a scientist. I've certainly heard people say it is radiological, it is radioactive. Whether it would be viewed as covered by, for instance, the nuclear weapons treaties, I don't know. But it doesn't matter because DU is illegal by general operation of humanitarian law, whether or not it's specifically under that treaty or it's considered poison under the Hague Convention of 1907. But the fact that there's disagreement about whether it's nuclear, radiological, or conventional also does not undermine the fact that it is illegal. The consequences of the use of illegal weaponry are clear in humanitarian law. They're under Hague Convention of 1903, Article 3. There's a duty for compensation for breaches. The Geneva Convention says, I'm just going to read this out. I know I have a couple, only more minutes. I want to read the language. I'll have to paraphrase it. Why? Military operations are prohibited when they cause exactly what DU does as far as undue suffering, illnesses, damage, etc., affect the health of people. I know the term war crimes is spread around a lot, and the term weapon of mass destruction is bandied around a lot. I caution about use of the term weapons of mass destruction. First of all, one cannot say that the United Nations said that about DU. The special representative writing about DU cautioned about the use of that term as well, preferring to limit it to large-scale nuclear bombs, perhaps thermobaric weaponry. But here's the provision. In the Fourth Geneva Convention, this provision is in all four conventions. A grave breach includes willful killing or inhumane treatment, willfully causing great suffering or serious injury to body or health of civilians. This is in the civilian thing. That's exactly what DU weapons do. And I think if I had more time, I would elaborate a little bit further on the genocidal aspects of depleted uranium, but my time is up. I'm open for questions, and I welcome hearing the next presenters. Thank you.